dignity of his person and the safety of his dominions. He silenced the messenger of an invasion who presumed to divert his attention in the most critical moment of the race, and by his command the importunate beacons were extinguished that too frequently spread the alarm from Tarsus to Constantinople. The most skilful charioteers obtained the first place in his confidence and esteem. Their merit was profusely rewarded. The emperor feasted in their houses and presented their children at the baptismal font. And while he applauded his own popularity, he affected to blame the cold and stately reserve of his predecessors. The unnatural lusts which had degraded even the manhood of Nero were banished from the world. Yet the strength of Michael was consumed by the indulgence of love and intemperance. In his midnight revels, when his passions were inflamed by wine, he was provoked to issue the most sanguinary commands. And if any feelings of humanity were left, he was reduced, with a return of sense, to approve the salutary disobedience of his servants. But the most extraordinary feature in the character of Michael is the profane mockery of the religion of his country. The superstition of the Greeks might indeed excite the smile of a philosopher, but his smile would have been rational and temperate, and he must have condemned the ignorant folly of a youth who insulted the objects of public veneration. A buffoon of the court was invested in the robes of the patriarch. His 12 metropolitans, among whom the emperor was ranked, assumed their ecclesiastical garments. They used or abused the sacred vessels of the altar, and in their bacchanalian feasts, the Holy Communion was administered in a nauseous compound of vinegar and mustard. Nor were these impious spectacles concealed from the eyes of the city. On the day of a solemn festival, the emperor, with his bishops or buffoons, rode on asses through the streets, encountered the true patriarch at the head of his clergy, and by their licentious shouts and obscene gestures, disordered the gravity of the Christian procession. The devotion of Michael appeared only in some offence to reason or piety. He received his theatrical crowns from the statue of the Virgin, and an imperial tomb was violated for the sake of burning the bones of Constantine, the iconoclast. By this extravagant conduct, the son of Theophilus became as contemptible as he was odious. Every citizen was impatient for the deliverance of his country, and even the favourites of the moment were apprehensive that a caprice might snatch away what a caprice had bestowed. In the 30th year of his age, and in the hour of intoxication and sleep, Michael III was murdered in his chamber by the founder of a new dynasty, whom the emperor had raised to an equality of rank and power.
The murderer of Michael III in 867 AD was Basil, called the Macedonian. The new emperor proved himself a brave military leader, heading the empire's forces against the encroachments of the Saracens and bringing much-needed order and justice to the empire's ramshackle social order. Says Gibbon, "In the character of a judge, he was assiduous and impartial, desirous to save but not afraid to strike. The oppressors of the people were severely chastised, but his personal foes, whom it might be unsafe to pardon, were condemned, after the loss of their eyes, to a life of solitude and repentance." Basil had four sons. Constantine died before his father. Stephen, the youngest, took on the role of a patriarch. Leo and Alexander were both invested with the purple, but government was solely exercised by Leo, who became Leo the Sixth.
The name of Leo the Sixth has been dignified with the title of philosopher, and the union of the prince and the sage, of the active and speculative virtues, would indeed constitute the perfection of human nature. But the claims of Leo are far short of this ideal excellence. The reputation of his philosophy and religion was overthrown by a domestic vice, the repetition of his nuptials. The primitive ideas of the merit and holiness of celibacy were preached by the monks and entertained by the Greeks. Marriage was allowed as a necessary means for the propagation of mankind. After the death of either party, the survivor might satisfy by a second union the weakness or the strength of the flesh. But a third marriage was censured as a state of legal fornication.
在线英语听力士，感谢您的收听，请推荐给身边的好友。